Reporting on politics and public policy is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. How much has the gun rights lobby changed South Dakota politics recently? What are the origins of the Capitol gun ban? Seth Tupper is an enterprise writer for the Rapid City Journal. John Schaff is professor of political science and department chair at Northern State University. And they're joining us today to talk about that and more on this week's Dakota Political Junkies. Seth is with us in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's downtown Rapid City studio space today. Seth Tupper, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
John Schaff is in the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio in Aberdeen at Northern State. Welcome, John.
Good to be here with you again.
All right, you can find the work of Seth Tupper at rapidcityjournal.com, and we're going to start here. We probably have time for about two conversations because there's so much meat in both of these, the Capitol gun ban and then history requirements, legislation looking at the history requirements in colleges in the state. Let's start with Capitol gun ban. And Seth, you've done quite a bit of work on this, and I'm wondering, you looked at the history of different things. Where did you sort of get started with this idea?
Well, I was curious, since we have an existing ban on guns in the Capitol, that's become really unpopular, especially among Republicans, and it was a bill was already passed a couple of years ago to repeal the ban, but it was vetoed by Governor Dugard. I wondered, how did an existing law get so unpopular? Obviously, it had to have been adopted at some point, and it had to have been popular. So, I started researching the history and found out that. The bill was actually adopted in 1993, and at that time, going back and looking at the news clippings and interviewing some people who were involved at the time, it was kind of a different world, and I was somewhat stunned to find out that a bill that both passed restrictions on guns in county courthouses and banned guns in the Capitol was passed with bipartisan support. I was able to dig up the roll call votes with the help of a very helpful research librarian at the state library, and such luminary Republicans as Mike Rounds, who was then in the legislature, voted for the Capitol gun ban. So did Roger Hunt, who was considered an extremely conservative lawmaker. So did David Munson, who went on to be mayor of Sioux Falls. Christy Feagin, who's now on the Public Utilities Commission. Carol Hillard, who later became lieutenant governor. All of these Republicans voted for this bill, which today, if they did that, would probably be political suicide.
Let's talk about what was the impetus for the bill in the first place? What was happening to where they felt that they needed this legislation?
Well, I talked to somebody named, are you talking about the original bill?
The original 1993 bill, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I talked to this Peter Gregory, who back in 93 was an assistant state's attorney in Minnehaha County, and he told me, gave me several examples. There had been some violent incidents in the Minnehaha County Courthouse and other courthouses around the state. And so he began researching, how do we get a handle on dangerous weapons in county courthouses? And he came across the fact that there was a law passed in 1983 saying that only the state and not counties and cities could pass laws dealing with gun possession. So He drafted a bill and went to the legislature and sought permission to ban guns and other dangerous weapons in county courthouses, and through the legislative process that was amended to also include the Capitol.
Seth, was it controversial at the time? Was it, what can you tell from, the votes cast or how it was sort of received at the time?
Not really, not in the way you would expect it to be today. The old news clippings showed that it was one of the bills that session, but it certainly wasn't the bill or didn't appear to be considered one of the major bills. There were certainly votes against it and statements made against it, but it didn't seem to blow up into the kind of controversy that we would expect today from anything dealing with gun rights.
Yeah. John Schaff, I want to bring you into the conversation with this notion of what's changed. I mean, a lot has changed since 1993. Start with the politics of what that would look like today, or what it does look like today, as lawmakers try to get rid of the Capitol gun ban.
I think the big change, and Seth and I chatted via email about this, and so some of this shows up in the nice article that they published in the Rapid City Journal over the weekend. But I think the big difference is that our political parties actually are weaker, which might seem counterintuitive, but the weakness of political parties has left a void that interest groups have filled in. And so interest groups have more power or more influence, I guess would probably be the better way to put it, over people in public office. And so one of the things that's going on, and Seth documents in his article, is that not just the National Rifle Association, but Seth's going to have to help me out. What's the other, the South Dakota Gun Owners, is that what they are?
Yes.
The other group, I think the South Dakota Gun Owners have a lot of influence over Republican legislators that they probably wouldn't have had, whatever that was, 25 years ago now. And this has occurred with both groups, with both parties, that we've gotten polarization in our political parties. And one of the things that has occurred, one of the manifestations of that, I think it's become harder. It sort of is a vicious circle or vicious cycle that as the parties become polarized, each party looks at the other side as being kind of wholly other, kind of the enemy, because there's nobody in that other party that you have any agreement with. Mm-hmm. And so any sign that you would compromise, that you would vote for something that the other side also believes in, is considered a sellout. And so there's a lot of pressure because of that polarization, because of the power of interest groups. And guns is an example here in our state of where it's pushed, in this case, the Republican Party to adopt a view on guns that really strident. And we didn't see that back in 1993, where you could get a good number of Republicans, as I remember from Seth's article. It was about half of Republicans in both House and Senate and peer voted for the ban. That's rough. He can correct me if I'm wrong on that. And we don't see that as much today, where you've got a bipartisan support for this or that particular issue.
Did you see this, Seth, in the State of the Union last night, or footage from the State of the Union, or just in general States of the Union, speeches by presidents where that pressure to, to stand up, to sit down, to use language that will make it embarrassing to stand up or sit down? I mean, we sort of see this division playing out on a national stage as well, yes?
Oh, absolutely. You saw not only division among Democrats and Republicans last night, but even the seating, with the many of the women lawmakers wearing white. There even seemed to be a division by gender last night, as if there wasn't enough division in the House of Representatives during the State of the Union already. But everybody was divided into their own little club or clique or interest group, and certainly many of the things during the speech.
Right. Well, a lot of the men were wearing white ribbons.
Right.
So it's not as noticeable on the camera. Do you think that the women dressing in white was an act of division or divisiveness?
I don't know if it was. It was just the optics when they would show the House of Representatives. You would see from behind the president, you would see on the left all these guys in suits, and on the right all these women. And of course, they were already divided by party, and so I just think it was just a reminder that things are already divisive in Washington and becoming more so seemingly every day.
Sure. John Schaff, thoughts on the president's message of unity at the State of the Union last night, and how that is there anything that we could say right now to sort of bring, and I'm tying that back, what I'm really asking you, John, is tying it back to mm-hmm. this notion of political parties weakening, and then flip that to a national stage with what we see playing out with the debate over the wall and the State of the Union address and people standing and sitting. It looks in some ways like those political parties are pretty strong right now, but you're saying not so fast.
Yeah, well, we'd make a distinction between what we call party and government, which is party as exists in the legislature or with the president, where that's still how we divide is based on party. But in the electorate and as an electoral force, parties are actually quite weak. We have all sorts of laws which have eviscerated the way that parties can control. Just one example would be, if the Republican Party was strong, Donald Trump wouldn't be president, right? I mean, because Donald Trump is a guy who donated lots of money to lots of Democrats. He has given no support in his lifetime, institutionally really, to the Republican Party.
Sure.
And no strong Republican Party would have ever nominated Donald Trump. But because of the primary system, you see Donald Trump, who's barely a Republican, as Republican nominee, and Bernie Sanders, who is literally not a Democrat. He had to change his party registration to run for the Democratic nomination. Almost won the Democratic nomination, despite the fact that he's not actually a Democrat. And that shows you the weakness of the political parties. And while, you know, I guess I expect the message of unity to, well, it, I don't know, it's 12:15 Central Time. It's probably over by now.
It might have been over at about.
Yeah, probably 12:15 last night. Yeah. But you can see it. You'll look at the look on Nancy Pelosi's face as she sits behind the president, you know, as she struggled to figure out, even if, you know, as Trump would say, the most anodyne thing. That thought going across her face, can I applaud this? Because I can't show any support whatsoever. I'm pretty sure Donald Trump could come out for, you know, Christmas puppies and baseball, and you'd get 90% of the Democratic caucus coming out against it. And that's just a sign, is that there's this game being played, is that neither side, and of course Donald Trump is sort of his own phenomenon. That's not merely partisanship. Right. But the idea that you would, in the least, give some sort of support for what the other side is doing is anathema. Again, you look at the Democrats running for president, where it's, why is Howard Schultz running as an independent, the CEO of Starbucks? Because he knows that as only kind of a moderate progressive, he can't get the nomination of his party, because there's a contest to see who can be furthest to the left and who can be most anti-Trump, right, amongst those who are either announced for president or, for all intents and purposes, have announced for president.
Yeah. I want to make sure we only have a couple minutes left and we get to House Bill. We should just make the junkies an hour long on during the legislative session.
I vote aye on that.
I don't know if you have the time, but we might have to extend these segments. There's so much more to talk about. But I want to make sure we touch briefly on House Bill 1087, which looks at U.S. history and government credits at the college level. And, John, give us a introduction to some of your thoughts on this legislation.
Sure. I should probably point out that I was in Pierre this morning. I'm pretty tired. I've been up since 3 o'clock. I drove to Pierre and back already today because I testified in favor of this bill, though I should note that my ultimate employer, the Board of Regents, is opposed, and my opinion is merely my opinion. It has nothing to do with my institution or my employer. And this bill is trying to do a couple things. One, it's trying to codify in law certain processes to defend academic freedom and intellectual diversity on campuses. And then a secondary thing it's doing in Section 11 of the bill is requiring graduates from our public institutions to take at least one U.S. government course and one U.S. history course, as well as then they're talking about doing a civics test, just like through K through 12 for the high school graduates, doing something like that for the college students. And I don't know, we'll see what happens. Sounds like there's going to be a vote in the committee this afternoon. We all testified this morning, and then there'll be a vote late this afternoon, early evening. My own view is that I think it's a good thing. Over the course of 20 years, we've had lots of curricular change in higher education in South Dakota, almost all of it at the expense of humanities and social science. I would call it lowering the standards, dumbing down our curriculum. And I would like to see some of that put back in. And I don't think that's going to come from within higher education. I think it has to come from without. Mm-hmm. And what the Board of Regents would say, because they did say it this morning with the executive director and the attorney, the general counsel for the Board of Regents, is they don't like the idea of the legislature putting mandates on the Board of Regents, and they're worried about unfunded mandates. Their reporting requirements as part of trying to defend the academic freedom and intellectual diversity, their reporting requirements from the universities put into the bill. And most people don't like filling out paperwork demanded by other people. So that's sort of the Regents' point of view on that. So we'll see what happens with that.